to reserve 2 minutes, please.
Okay. Here we go.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is David Moody. I represent the appellant. The appellant is Amanda, a developmentally disabled female. In the words of the Kent School District, who first assessed Amanda when she was 5 years old, Amanda is mentally retarded. Amanda operates on the level of an 8-year-old child. At school, during class, in the boys' bathroom, Amanda was sexually victimized on multiple occasions, orally, anally, and digitally. A 6-week trial was marred by many legal errors. This morning, I'll focus on 2 errors of law. First, the misapplication of Evidence Rule 412, which does not permit evidence pertaining to a victim's sexual predisposition or other sexual behavior. And secondly, I'd like to focus on what can only be characterized as hopelessly inconsistent jury instructions and special verdict forms. There's no way to tell how the jury would have determined breach, causation, or damages if the trial court would have complied with Evidence Rule 412 and would have given consistent jury instructions. Let's start with the jury instructions. It is reversible error to give contradictory jury instructions. Here, the plaintiffs offered pattern jury instructions. We stuck to the WPIs. 11.04 and 11.05 discuss the fact that the negligence of a parent is not imputed to the child pursuant to statute. That's 4.22020. Those instructions were given by the trial court. However, the defense offered a jury instruction that was completely contradictory, jury instruction number 23, which instructed the jury to determine the degree of the parent's negligence when assessing Amanda's claims. The court also gave a special verdict form that linked up with the improper jury instruction 23. These are irreconcilable instructions on a material point. The defendants made parental fault a material point throughout trial. The jury instructions on parental fault were inconsistent, they were confusing, and they're not an accurate reflection of the law, as we see in WPI 11.04, 11.05, and most importantly, 4.22.020. In the Hall versus Catholic Archbishop case, which was decided by our Supreme Court over 4 decades ago, the Supreme Court makes it clear that it is prejudicial error to give irreconcilable jury instructions on a material issue. And furthermore, the court goes on to say that it's impossible to know what effect those may have had on the verdict. The jury instructions being irreconcilable mandates that this court remand this case for a new trial. Another error of law that stands out and hits us right in the face is the misapplication of Evidence Rule 412. The trial court committed reversible error when it allowed the school district to introduce evidence of, quote, other sexual behavior about this developmentally disabled girl. The court allowed evidence is too strong of a word, it's speculation, it was innuendo about Amanda having sex with a cousin when she was a little girl, age 4. And the court allowed evidence that Amanda was prescribed birth control. The trial court allowed the defendant to use this evidence to rebut that Amanda was damaged and to establish how getting repeatedly molested at school was not the cause of her damage. It was a damaged goods argument, and the court allowed that to be made by not applying Evidence Rule 412. 412 is very broad. It contains a strong protection against all history of other sexual behavior. It reflects a policy that there is a presumption, a strong presumption of inadmissibility, unless there's a showing of probative value that far outweighs the danger of harm to the victim. Here, the case involves the repeated sexual molestation of a minor disabled girl. Unsubstantiated stories about past sexual conduct are particularly harmful and reckless, and birth control is completely off limits. Yet here, the trial court allowed the defense expert to weigh the probative value of this presumptively inadmissible evidence. I'll quote now from Report of Proceedings, page 56. This is the words of the trial court. If defendant's expert finds that it is relevant, that would be something where the probative value substantially outweighs the danger of harm, and that would be admissible. The trial court abdicated the ER 412 balancing test to the defense expert. Our Supreme Court tells us in the Cusera versus Department of Transportation case that failure to exercise discretion is an abuse of discretion. The law on this is clear. In Ortega Martinez, which is a Supreme Court case from 1994, it clearly states that the consequences of sexual intercourse must be gauged at the time of the act.
Did the court give a limiting instruction to the jury on what that evidence could be used for?
The court did not. There was no limiting instruction.
Was there a request for one?
There was not a request for a limiting instruction. There was briefing and more briefing and more briefing, pocket briefs on why this was simply off limits. We certainly preserved the record. Accusations about sex with a cousin that happened 8 to 12 years before she was victimized at school are not closely related in time, and it would violate Ortega Martinez. Most importantly, this court, Division I, makes it clear, and this is right on point, that the trial court should not have allowed any of this evidence. I'll quote this court, where the lack of capacity is based on a permanent organic condition, that's what we have here, following with the quote, it logically follows that prior acts of intercourse cannot demonstrate that the victim understands the nature and consequences because the prior acts may have occurred due to the same lack of capacity. The risk of undue prejudice from the admission of such evidence is high, while the benefit to the defense is insubstantial. That's State versus Summers, Division 1, 1993. The trial court allowed unfounded allegations about Amanda having sex at age 4, did not properly balance the, quote, high risk of, quote, unfair prejudice against the insubstantial benefit to the defendant, gave blind deference to the defense expert, and ignored this court's decision in Summers. There's no way to know what value the jury placed on this improperly admitted evidence, and a new trial is necessary. I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Andrew Biggs. I'm the attorney for the Kent School District who is respondent in this case. The court has probably noticed that this case is very unusual in many respects. For example, no plaintiff testified at trial. The mother didn't testify at trial. The girl didn't testify at trial. The plaintiffs opened their case with an expert witness. Through that expert witness, they tried to establish damages. They tried to establish causation. They tried to establish proximate cause. They put two more witnesses on, a lay witness, and finally one more expert. Three experts and one lay witness who really had little to offer in this case. That was a tactical, strategic move on the plaintiff's part. One can only imagine how crazy that must look now, but that was their choice, and they did that on purpose. Yet, because of the shotgun style that they took with this case, it took several more weeks to debunk all these arguments that we just heard. Now, we're hearing the same things today, and we're seeing the exact same things in the brief. Just now, Mr. Moody said, sexually victimized. He said, orally, anally and digitally penetrated and sodomized, repeatedly molested. I ask you, where in the record is there support for these claims? The jury heard that for 6 weeks, and the jury rejected that. The jury decided that Mr. Moody is not correct, and his clients who did not testify could not change what the actual facts of the case are.
Well, what fact wasn't found by the jury? That the victimized aspect of that?
Yes, correct.
Everything else was consistent with the jury's verdict. That she was penetrated wasn't at issue, right?
Actually, Your Honor, there is no evidence of exactly what happened. What Mr. Mills, who is the boy who is involved, who's also slightly delayed himself, he said, we tried, but it wasn't very successful. That's really all he had to say. We don't know what happened in that bathroom. Nobody knows, because Amanda didn't testify. What she said and what the jury heard, and by the way, the historic side of this is she didn't take the stand, so we had her video deposition. And we played a portion of that, 20 minutes or so, for the jury, so they at least got some feel for how impaired she actually was, what she actually had to say about this. And what Amanda said in her video deposition was, we were in the bathroom. Yes, somebody came in one time while we were in the bathroom. We were quiet because we didn't want to get caught. That's what the jury heard. And that's the only evidence, other than what Mr. Mills had to say, about what actually happened in the bathroom. There's a total void here about how many times, if it was once, twice, whatever. We know from hearsay that Amanda told some people that it happened twice, told her mother it happened twice. Of course, her mother also didn't testify, so we don't know specifically what she said about it. So the answer to your question, Your Honor, with all respect, is no, there is no competent evidence of what happened in that bathroom. The word sodomy is such a big buzzword we hear over and over again. And the true fact of this case is, and what the plaintiffs can't accept.
I thought there was testimony from Mills that Amanda expressed a preference for anal sex so that she wouldn't get pregnant.
Yes, she did. He did say that she. It was her idea. Yes.
That was at trial, right?
That was at trial. Okay. Yes. But what he didn't say, he said, we tried. It wasn't very successful. We don't really know what the details are. I think the assumption would probably be that it wasn't very successful. They didn't know what they were doing. I mean, I think that's probably where everybody gets left with this. But the very fact of what you're talking about, she expressed her knowledge that sex leads to pregnancy. See, and these are the keystone to this case. What the plaintiffs came in, and I'll remind the court that all the pleadings, the motions and so forth leading up to the trial were Amanda was forcibly raped against her will. Everything says that. That was their entire theory until the first day of trial. Then they realized they're not going to sell that. There's absolutely no way they're going to sell that. We have evidence from the Harborview nurse who's trained in sexual assault. The nurse says, I asked her about those things. She was comfortable. She was pleasant. She was not traumatized. She said she was a willing participant. We had testimony from the detective who's in the special assault unit, who's trained in this very area. The detective said the very same thing. There's no crime. It was two students fooling around in the bathroom. We had the evidence from the counselor who, before this ever happened and who knew this could happen, didn't tell the school. The counselor said Amanda wanted to have sex. She wanted birth control so she wouldn't get pregnant and so on. So there's plenty of evidence here about what Amanda knew, what Amanda wanted, and all these sorts of things.
What came in under this challenge DR 412 ruling?
Well, the motion actually had dealt with a number of different items of evidence, and the two that are at issue here, the court actually rejected several of them ones that were requested. There was probably, I think there might have been six total requested, two were allowed. The two that were allowed were the issue about having sex, which Amanda described as vaginal sex with her cousin, and the other was that she sought out birth control from, you know, in order to not get pregnant. And first of all, I think it's absolutely incredible for the plaintiff to argue that the judge did not weigh what these things meant and do a balancing test about whether ER 412 was properly met, because we argued this for some length, and you can tell from the record there were lots of arguments, there were briefing. The court clearly considered and accepted and rejected different portions of what was offered. So what we were left with in the end was Amanda said that she had sex with her cousin voluntarily, not molested, as the plaintiff keeps saying, but she said to her counselor, and this was mere months before this bathroom stuff happened, she said, that she stopped having sex with her cousin, Sunil, because she didn't want to have, I forget her words, but basically a child that was not birth defect issue. That tells us, forget about the history of sex and so on, what it tells us is that she has the sophistication to know that intra-family sexual relations can lead to birth defects, which is a fairly sophisticated concept. And by the way, you know, we know she, for example, takes math and science classes in general education. She's not what the plaintiffs present her as being, and there's lots of evidence of that. But notwithstanding, the issue of sex with the cousin was mentioned to the counselor specifically, and the counselor took that for certain purposes. We had a CR35 exam done. That Shirley Feldman Summers, who's quite experienced in this area, found that to be a very meaningful piece of showing what her knowledge was, what her ability was. Because let's remember, they keep saying she can't consent, she can't consent, she can't consent. Why can't she consent? That's what they never told the jury, why she can't consent. And they put this guy on from California, Dr. Urquiza, who's coming in here saying she can't consent. And he takes his position that all of her damages came from this specific sexual adventure with this specific kid, ignoring that she had earlier sexual experience. It obviously goes to her damages, and that she had sex with another kid at school, which her counselor and mother knew about, this Eric Warren, the spring before. The issue of what that does with the damages is extremely important. And had they not tried to mislead the jury about what the damages were and whether or not there was, it's one thing, Your Honor, to say we're not going to talk about history, we're not going to talk about how this might affect somebody. It's something else to walk into court and pretend like there's one event in this person's life that changed their life forever. And that's what the plaintiffs did here. On the birth control side, there was the issue that Amanda specifically said to her counselor, and her counselor, by the way, is the one that took her to get birth control. She told her counselor at the teen clinic, I want to have sex with this kid. I already had sex. I want to have sex with this other kid, and I need birth control. No one can take me. I need to figure out a way to do this. So the counselor took her to the teen clinic, and she got birth control. And the teen clinic physician also testified about Amanda's knowledge, because, of course, the statute tells us you need to have awareness of what sexual relations are, what the effect is, and so forth, which includes, obviously, pregnancy and disease, which were addressed by the counselor. I think what's missing in this case, Your Honor, and what the plaintiffs sort of keep dodging around here is just because a person has a mild mental issue of some sort does not mean that person can't have sex, does not mean that person cannot consent to sex. In fact, if you look at the definition of rape, second degree, it talks about people and the certain conditions under which people with disabilities can have sex, and certain ones when they can't, for example, if it's a driver of a vehicle. And so just because a person has difficulties does not mean they can't have a family, have a sexual life. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
What's missing here is a recognition that we're in the Court of Appeals, and that there were many, many legal errors. You didn't hear opposing counsel get up and refute anything about the inconsistent jury instructions. Completely irreconcilable. A complete disregard for RCW 4.22.020. You didn't hear opposing counsel come up and say anything about Evidence Rule 412, the Ortega-Martinez decision. And yet you did hear the opposing counsel say that sex acts should be allowed to show consent when the victim is disabled. That's exactly what this division said cannot be allowed in State versus Summers, where the lack of capacity is based on permanent organic condition. It logically follows that prior acts of intercourse cannot demonstrate that the victim understands the nature and consequences because the prior acts may have occurred due to the same lack of capacity. This decision will be the ficens of Evidence Rule 412 when it comes to victims of sexual abuse. if you are going to allow evidence of people getting birth control and allegations and innuendos about what may or may not have happened when 12 years prior, when someone was 4 years old, then ER 412 won't have any meaning. There were multiple acts of sex in that bathroom. It was orally, anally, digitally. Mills, the other kid, the kid who did it, he said it happened. Kent Security testified that it happened. At trial, Mills pled the fifth. The school decided to kick Mills out because he had sex with this disabled girl time and time again. They didn't kick Amanda out. Your Honors, this comes down to errors of law, not trial court closing arguments. The court committed errors of law when it gave irreconcilable instructions and when it allowed in clearly inadmissible and presumptively inadmissible evidence about sexual predisposition. We ask that you remand this for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you.